There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. Then a strange blight crept over the area and everything began to change. There was a strange stillness. The few birds seen anywhere were moribund. They trembled violently and could not fly. It was a spring without voices. On the mornings that had once throbbed with the dawn chorus of scores of bird voices, there was now no sound, and only silence lay over the fields and the woods and the marshes. So wrote the author Rachel Carson in 1962 in a well-known book called Silent Spring. I don't know if anyone has read it. It's very popular in the States. In that book, she challenged a particular issue in the environment of her day, the use of an insecticide, DDT, in agriculture. And she portrayed in graphic, and some would say imaginary terms, its effect on bird life. She was ridiculed and attacked by the chemical industry, by the scientific establishment, and by government departments. Yet eventually DDT was banned, and Silent Spring is regarded by many as the beginning of the modern environmental movement. In that book, it portrays a natural world under attack, a natural world that silently cries out for help. And it's a cry that many people are quite rightly sensitive to in our day and age. And it's a cry that we ought to hear as Christians as well, one that we should be ashamed when we ignore it. Now, next year, we're going to be looking at some contemporary topics, I hope, in the run-up to the election, assuming that Tony doesn't cut and run too soon with his election date. We'll be looking at various issues that, from a biblical perspective, as we think about the decisions that will be taken in the government of our country. And when we get to there, I hope that we will spend a little bit of time on the practical responsibilities that we have to the environment as Christians. But my focus tonight is more theological than practical. Because although secular environmentalism, as represented by Silent Spring, does indeed hear creation crying out, it doesn't understand the words. Secular environmentalism does not truly grasp what the world is crying out for. But the first and most important text for environmental things, the Bible, does. And as we follow this theme from the Old to the New Testament, we will see, I hope, that creation, in both its glory and its pain, cries out for Jesus Christ. Specifically, we'll see in three sections, it cries out for him as the God who made it, it cries out for him as the Lord who redeems it, and it cries out for him as the man who rules it. So let's try and see how those three things work out. It cries out, first of all, for Jesus Christ as the God who made it in the first place. We've already read from Colossians, speaking about the Son of God, haven't we? For by him all things were created, it says. But of course, this is a New Testament insight. We won't find anything quite so clear about the role of the Son in creation in the Old Testament. And the reason for that is relatively simple. God does not reveal all the truth about himself at once in the Bible. It is revealed gradually and progressively over time, over the course of history and his dealings with the nation of Israel. And the doctrine of the Trinity, the truth that God is one being in three persons, awaits the New Testament to be revealed clearly to us. It's not taught in an explicit way in the Old Testament. And therefore, we don't find any text in the Old Testament that says God the Father created through God the Son. We don't find any text that says it in that bald kind of way. So did then Jesus find nothing to say about his role in creation as he talks his disciples through the Old Testament and explained how it all pointed to him? Well, not so fast. It may not have been obvious on the surface, but once you know what to look for, there is something to be found, isn't there? Let's turn back to Genesis. We'll be majoring on Genesis 1 to 3 this evening. And I will make some references elsewhere, but I don't think you'll need to be turning those up if you listen as I read them to you. But look again at those first three verses of Genesis 1 to 3 that we're all very familiar with. Verses 1 to 3 of chapter 1 I'm talking about. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And so we remember that in the Genesis account, God creates by speaking words. And the Spirit, which is the breath in ancient Hebrew, hovers over the waters, waiting to put those words into effect. Now, with that in mind, and these verses open in front of you, listen as I read to you from John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. And the similarities, the echoes between John chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 1 are quite deliberate. They're not accidental at all. John wants us to remember, as we read his words, that God created by speaking. John wants us to remember that when he says that Jesus is the Word. The picture of God creating in Genesis is of a voice in the darkness speaking words by his breath. And John, and indeed Paul, tell us that the voice and the word and the breath are distinct living persons. And that Jesus is the incarnation of the Word by whom everything was created. Jesus is that person of God, become a human being and living amongst us. So, does this mean that when you gaze at the stars, or hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees, or dig up a fat juicy carrot from your garden, does this mean that you should be able to look at those things and deduce the doctrine of the Trinity? No. No, it doesn't, of course not. You should be able to look at those things and deduce there is a God, and he must be very, very great to create even a carrot, let alone a sky full of stars. You should be able to deduce that, according to Romans chapter 1. But it would have to be a pretty unusual carrot to portray the Trinity with any kind of accuracy. The stars and the birds by themselves don't specifically tell us about the deity of Jesus Christ, do they? It's only with the retrospect of the New Testament that we learn that he is the God who made them. He is the Word that spoke them into being. And maybe if we had been there and we'd seen the bread and the fishes multiplying as Jesus broke them in his hands, matter appearing from nothing, the more he breaks them, the more appears. Maybe if we'd seen that, we might have noticed that Jesus was really rather competent at these things. He knew exactly what he was doing. He'd done this before. But there's more, isn't there? Because Colossians said, not only was it made by him, but also for him as well. Now you know the story of Goldilocks, don't you? Deep in the woods, Goldilocks finds a mysterious cottage with a neat garden and a thatched roof and whitewashed walls and smoke curling from the chimney. She sneaks inside And there she sees three bowls of steaming porridge, three chairs and three neatly made beds. Maybe Goldilocks ponders in her mind how this has come about. Perhaps it occurs to her that a freak tornado whirled through the lumberyard, a cookery shop and a field of oats, and it all happened by chance. Or maybe not. Maybe she concludes that a million years ago, that was a Stone Age hut and it's evolved to become a nice neat cottage. No, I don't think so. Goldilocks understands that the cottage and the porridge had to be made by someone. It wouldn't have just happened by itself. But the silly, naughty girl doesn't grasp that the porridge and the chairs and the beds were not only made by someone, they were also made for someone as well. Someone who was going to come home pretty soon by the looks of that porridge. Colossians 1 tells us that creation was made not only by the Son, but for the Son of God too. Now this should ring some Old Testament bells as well, if you're familiar. What did God do once he had created this universe, or as he made it? Well, he looks at it each day, and he saw with a growing satisfaction that it's good, this world he's made. He made creatures to reflect his image throughout it, so that in a sense he's there. He rested, not because he's tired, but in order to enjoy it and appreciate it. And he made himself present within it. He walked through it in the cool of the day. And that creation which he has made cries out, not only is there a God who made it, but also who wants to make himself known and present within it. And the New Testament tells us that his name is Jesus Christ. And that's what happens when the Christ is born. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. The Creator returns to live within his creation, in spite of our best efforts to keep him out. That's what he made it for. And creation, like the Three Bears Cottage, cries out for the God by whom and for whom it was made. But Goldilocks, the thieving little wretch, does not respect the purpose for which the porridge, the chairs, and the beds are waiting. She proceeds to trash the place, doesn't she? She gobbles the porridge, she smashes up the furniture, and she makes a right mess of the bed linen, and before collapsing in her gorged and bloated torpor into the poor baby's cot. Which brings us to the second point. Creation cries out not only for the God who created it, but for the Son who will redeem it. Because like the Three Bears Cottage, there is creation has been abused. It has been trashed by an interloper. But this, of course, is no fairy tale. Turn on to Genesis chapter 3. And most of us will be familiar with the story, I'm sure. A serpent appears, standing for the devil, tempts Adam and Eve to break the one rule that God has given them. And then God himself appears, confronts the man and the woman with what they've done. We'll pick it up in verse 13. Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all the livestock and all the wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Now, how does that hymn go? And through the woods and forest glades I wander, and hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees. Then sings my soul, my Saviour God, to me, how great thou art, how great thou art. And isn't it wonderful? Isn't there a great truth in that? Isn't birdsong very, very beautiful? So long as you don't actually know what the birds are singing. Because if you know what the bird song means, it ain't so pretty. But for your information and edification, let me translate for you some of the most popular lyrics that you will hear in the fields and hedgerows and gardens around here. I'm the best, I'm the best, look at me girls, I'm the best. Right? Oi, you, get out of my tree. Come over here if you think you're hard enough. The robins sing that one particularly. My babies, the fox has eaten all my babies. Or the perennial favourite, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. Wherever you fly to, I'll catch you and I'll kill you. And so on. That is what the birds are actually singing. That's what most bird songs actually mean, I'm afraid. And it's those friendly little robins with their cheeky red breasts and all year round songs that are the worst, you know. Stroppy little bright as they are. For all the beauty and the wonder that, of course, still remains in creation, for all that it is still a hymn of praise to God, remember now that it is spoiled, that it is under a curse, that it is in distress. As Paul puts it later, and we'll read this at the end, all creation is in bondage to decay, groaning as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. So when Rachel Carson wrote in Silent Spring, there was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. Well, she's actually perpetrating a myth. The myth that everything is all right with nature if only we don't mess it up by our silliness or greed or carelessness. In fact, it just looks all right because that's the way that we are used to it. If we could see creation in its pristine state, as God originally intended, we would realise that what we live in now, for all its wonder, is a battle zone. It is a cancer ward. Though it's still marvellous, it now does limp along with a dysfunctional screech, rather than with a glorious, harmonious chorus. That is the hard fact of life in our world. Charles Darwin saw it, didn't he? Nature red in tooth and claw. And he found it impossible to believe in a God of love creating like that. Of course, he didn't understand the effects that the fall had brought in. But of course, human pollution and degradation of the environment have added so much insult to that original injury caused by the fall and the curse. So just as the broken chairs and the spilt porridge and the unmade beds cry out in silent reproach against Goldilocks for the bears to come home and chuck her out, so earth and nature cry out against the abuse that it has suffered and for redemption from the decay and the futility that all things have been subject to. If only Charles Darwin had realised that. Not that nature red in tooth and claw disproved the existence of God, so much as proved the need for salvation and for a deliverer. But we believe that such a salvation has come. So let's pause and stand and sing number 393. Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Before we unfold some more of this theme. 393. Now, when Jesus took his disciples through the Old Testament and showed how it pointed to him, we don't know what he referred to, but I'm virtually certain that he must have referred to a particular verse here in Genesis chapter 3. Because we find right back when the curse on creation began, God also hinted that he was going to provide an answer to it. And it's chapter 3, verse 15. Chapter 3, verse 15. Funny how many important verses are 3 verse something, aren't they? 3 verse 15, 3 verse 16. There's a great sermon series there somewhere, but anyway. It says, God speaking says, "And I will put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, and between her offspring and hers." Sorry, your offspring and hers. "He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel," said God. Now this, of course, is the earliest promise of the Christ to come that we find in the Bible. One day promised God, the offspring of the woman, notice, not the offspring of the man, but of the woman, will come and he will experience for himself the poison of our fallen world. The snake will bite his heel, yet he will crush that snake under his foot. And this, of course, is a picture of what Christ does for us. He, of course, is the only man of whom it can be said he is the seed of a woman, but not of a man. And he does this, of course, on the cross and in the resurrection. He bears and he overcomes the sting of death and sin in order to destroy the power of the devil. And until he achieves and completes and applies that victory, the silent spring, the groaning of our natural world, cries out not only for its creator to return, but also for its tormentor to be removed. So Rachel Carson and other secular environmentalists are quite right to perceive that the natural world does need a rescue, a redemption. It's crying out for someone to stand up for it. And they're quite right to challenge us all to take seriously environmental issues. But the world will never be healed by our best efforts, because the basic problem is one of spiritual evil. Not merely human fallibility, but spiritual evil in the highest places. And so sin and death will never be undone by the Kyoto Protocol or anything like it, though they may have wisdom to them. They need the Lord himself to die and to rise again and then to return from heaven to make all things new, to be solved. And environmentalists should challenge us to consider our behaviour and our accountability for how we use God's world and handle God's world. But they should not portray humanity as the great enemy. Humanity as a polluting, spoiling interloper into the world. To return to our fairy tale, Goldilocks in the story does not stand for humanity. Goldilocks stands for the devil. Because Goldilocks had no right to be in the house. She had no right to the porridge. Whereas we have every right to be here on planet Earth. It's just what we do with it that's the problem. Remember, Jesus came to crush Satan under his feet, but to redeem mankind, his people at least, and to restore us to our proper place in things. Creation cries out for its creator. Creation cries out for its redeemer that will rescue it from the power of evil. And finally, and our final point, creation cries out for a man who rules it as well. Look back to Genesis chapter 1 and remember what God's purpose in creating humanity is in the first place. Verse 26. "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." And then verse 31, "God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day." You see, God created and made creation to be ruled by mankind in his image, reflecting his authority. He made mankind to be ruling creation in that way. It was good before he made mankind and put him in charge, but it was very good, notice that in verse 31, after man was in charge. And we shouldn't be embarrassed or apologetic for the way God made things, even if we are embarrassed as to what we've done with our responsibilities since then. The environmental movement likes to pin the destruction of the environment on Christianity and say it's because of these verses that everything has gone wrong. But that actually can be shown to be a historical and certainly a biblical fallacy, even though at times these verses have been misused and misapplied. So we shouldn't be embarrassed or apologetic for what the Bible says about the role of humanity in God's plan. And the marvellous thing is that God's plans have not changed since these days, since creation. God's plan is still to have mankind in charge of all his creation. It's still his plan. It hasn't failed. And maybe Jesus referred to these verses with his friends on the road to Emmaus. And if he didn't, I'm sure he perhaps quoted Psalm 8 to them. We've read this several times in our services in recent months, and it's very important. When I consider your heavens, says Psalm 8, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honour. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet. And maybe as Jesus reminded them of these words, maybe he also reminded them of how the wind and the waves, or the fish in the Lake of Galilee, or even a dead corpse in a grave, responded to the voice of a man. That's why they obey, you know. It's not just because Jesus is God, but also because Jesus is a man. And as a man, his role is to rule. And maybe, like in Hebrews chapter 2, Jesus made it clear that he, perhaps speaking in the third person, was the man God had sent to fulfill all his purposes for the human race from the very beginning of time. And that just in just a little while, everything would be under his feet and being put back together again. DDT was banned in America in 1972, 10 years after Silent Spring was published. Rachel Carson had already died of cancer many years before. The environmental movement consider this to be one of their first and greatest triumphs. Even that came a little late in the day. If you've got an accurate enough chemical spectrometer, you can find traces of DDT in the fat of polar bears in the Arctic and blue whales at the Antarctic. It touches every part of our planet and it lasts forever. But at least the environmental movement shows that something can be done, something can be achieved. And maybe we think, about time too. How foolish of us. What on earth possessed mankind to poison planet Earth with such a stuff in the first place? Well, I'll tell you what did. It's called the Anopheles mosquito, I think. Is that right? It spreads malaria. Malaria kills people. It kills thousands and thousands and thousands of people every year. The World Health Organization estimates that between 50 and 100 million human lives have been saved since DDT, by DDT since its invention at the start of the Second World War. And the man who invented it justly got the Nobel Prize. And a great many countries are very keen to keep on using DDT because nothing else really seems to do the job. Especially poor, developing countries with vulnerable populations and limited medical facilities to treat those who suffer from malaria. And there's the rub. And it just goes to show, it's not actually easy to run a planet. Not anymore. Not now we're sinners. And the planet doesn't particularly like being run by us anymore. And it only goes to show that though we must take the environment seriously, we must have a rounded perspective on all these things as we do so. Nonetheless, we must try to do it. We must try to make the judgment, the balances, thinking carefully and biblically about what God's priorities are. We won't always get it right. Often we'll get it wrong. But not being involved, not making the hard decisions, is simply not an option. We have a calling. And our calling as a human race is to prick our fingers on the thorns as we wrestle to try and achieve the best result we can in this fallen world. And as we prick our fingers, and as we face the anxiety and the dilemmas and the fears that surround us in our world today with all of the things that are going wrong, we should add our own voices to the cry of creation, the groans of a suffering world. And our voices should say, come back, Jesus. Come back and put things right. Come back and remake everything new. Come back and put us straight so that we can be the people that we are called to be. And if we do turn to him and trust him, we find that he sows in our hearts, through faith, the seed of a new creation where things are different. And so by following Jesus Christ, we become part of the hope for which creation longs. Let me finish by reading to you from the book of Romans, chapter 8, as Paul comments on this topic. He writes, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. That's us. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. That's us. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But if we hope for what we do not have, we wait for it patiently. And we wait patiently for the Lord himself to come back and make everything